Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilcrease Museum recently opened an exhibit from the Bob Dylan Center that accomplishes two aims, according to my guest today. Michael Chaikin is the archivist and curator of the Dylan Archives, and he says Bob Dylan's face value and beyond strengthens the partnership between the center and the Helmreich Center for American Research at Gilcrease, where the archives are stored, by demonstrating the visual side of Dylan's artistry. The focal point of the exhibit is a series of large portraits Dylan did, titled Face Value, along with a number of visual art projects Dylan has done over the years, from album covers to illustrated lyric and poetry projects. Plus, the exhibit gives visitors a small peek at what's to come when the Bob Dylan Center opens in a few years, as the exhibit features memorabilia, film, and photos from some key moments in Dylan's career. Michael Chaikin joins us today to talk about Bob Dylan, Face Value and Beyond, on display now through September 15th at Gilcrease Museum. Michael Chaikin, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here, as always.
I had the sense that this exhibit is designed to give viewers just a small taste, a sense of what the Bob Dylan Center will be when it opens in a few years.
Yeah.
Was that the case, or was it something larger with this exhibit?
Absolutely. I mean, in the immediate, the Bob Dylan Center is not going to be opened until 2021. We're still working to lay out the design of that and thinking about the exhibitions. But in the meantime, we've been processing and cataloging and preserving the Bob Dylan Archive, which essentially is going to be the beating heart of the Bob Dylan Center. And we've been doing that work at the Helmreich Center for American Research, which is adjacent to the Gilcrease Museum. It's where they keep all their rare manuscripts. They have a conservation laboratory. And they've been allowing us to use that real estate. It's a fantastic facility. So they've been a very important partner for us. And, you know, over the past year or so, we've been talking, we need to do some sort of exhibition. We should do some sort of collaboration, because we have been getting a lot of people turning up at Gilcrease and saying, okay, where's the Dylan stuff? Can we see Dylan stuff? And, until the Bob Dylan Center opens in 2021, we really don't have like a public face yet. I mean, essentially, the Dylan Center is going to be the public-facing entity. The archive is still semi-private. We're processing it. Researchers have been using it, but you kind of have to have a reason to be in there.
And you really have to process it first before even researchers can get in there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big part of why we're doing this, is to preserve this work and to understand it better and to catalog it. But having researchers in early helps, because some of the folks that we've had in have kind of helped us focus and say, oh, did you know you had this, that, and the other thing? Or here's a fragment of a song that we thought was, didn't exist, and here it is, so here's proof. So the researchers that have been coming in, particularly people like Clinton Halen, who's one of Dylan's principal biographers and knows Bob's history chapter and verse, he's been able to actually pinpoint some things that we didn't even know we had. So, it's been it's been helpful, but at the same time, again, it's not really open to the public. And so, we had this opportunity. There was a beautiful gallery space in Gilcrease that opened up, and we said, let's do something, that would not kind of give away the fort, but at the same time, give people a sense of what the texture of the archive is, the kind of things we have in the archive. But, more importantly, we wanted to we wanted to do an exhibition that was kind of harmonious with what the Gilcrease Museum already do. And so we had the opportunity to exhibit a series of portraits that Bob made in 2013 called Face Value. And these showed at the National Portrait Gallery in London. They showed in Germany, but they haven't really been seen much since. One of the drawings in that series ended up as an album cover for one of his records called Another Self-Portrait. And turns out that entire series, that entire Face Value series, was acquired by some colleagues of ours. And they had the entire series here in the States. And they very generously said, yeah, if you'd like to borrow it and show it, absolutely. So we took that to the Gilcrease Museum, and they were interested. But the one thing we can do with the archive that you couldn't do in London or, Germany or anywhere, is not only can we show this work, relatively recent work, but we could also pull things out of the archive to give it a little bit more context.
To see that this is not like, and I'm using, there's a number of celebrities that,
100%,
that I mean, Tony Bennett, you go to see Tony Bennett sing, you don't go to see his artwork.
Yeah, 100%.
There's a number of artists like that who've got into art. But you can see with Dylan, this has been a concern going way back.
No, that's a very good point. You know, usually, you know, a writer like Norman Mailer decided he wanted to make films. He directed 4 films. A pop star like Kanye West decides he wants to do fashion, and immediately people think, oh, they're just dilettantes. Like, you know, this is what they're known for. And so they take a lot of arrows and a lot of criticism for doing that. And, you know, the same with Dylan. I mean, Dylan started to exhibit his paintings maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But he'd been drawing since childhood. And he's been painting since the early to mid-60s. So it goes way back. And some of his art has kind of creeped out through the years. Album covers, magazine covers. And we show some of that in the exhibition. But again, what we wanted to do is we wanted to show this new work in the context of the Gilcrease Museum, but also pull things out of the archive that would give you some sense that this isn't a lark. This is something Bob has been interested and involved with the visual arts going back decades.
And there's something from the archive that really sort of puts this recent work that is the face value portraits in perspective, and that is a set of artist proofs from I guess it's about 1970 from his self-portraits. Mm-hmm. That one ended up being the album cover, but you can see a whole set of them. And the connections seem pretty obvious. When you look on one wall and you see this work from 1970 and you see these whole series of portraits from 2013, you say, well, this looks like the same artist.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the themes of the show is just portraiture. Bob painting his own portrait in 1970, to Bob painting portraits of other people, to other artists of some renown trying to capture Bob or create his portrait in some way. You know, in when we think about Dylan and how to present him, we want to show the totality of Bob as an artist. And not only, of course, as a writer, singer, songwriter, but he was also a filmmaker. He was also a painter. He had a radio show. He was a disc jockey for a number of years. And all that stuff is of a piece. You know, I think, you know, the way to think about this stuff is these aren't just these like separate paths. They're all part of the same wellspring of this kind of restless creativity. And, you know, to do a show like Face Value, people, you know, might say, well, why are you, he's a singer. Why are you doing a painting show? But particularly an artist like Dylan, you know, to go in the front door is tough. It's just his legacy is so enormous that it's almost better to go in through the side door and look for smaller details and then expand outward from that. And you could learn a lot from that. And invariably, his drawings touch on all sorts of things in his life and his career.
Yeah, and there's almost like a set of doodle prints that they almost look like doodles in a way, but they're kind of cool in their own way. There's one that I think it was from like the 60s or early 70s. And it's like, it looks like you flash forward about 15 years and you can see noted contemporary artist doing that same design. It's like a Bryce Martin design, you know, with all these little squirrely lines going all over the place. So, I mean, obviously he was very much affected by the visual arts.
Yeah, for sure. Suze Rodolo, who was Bob's girlfriend in the early 60s, talks about in her book, taking Bob to see Matisse for the first time in the early 60s and how much of an impression that made. And then when you look at some of the work that started to trickle out, Bob painted the front cover of the band's debut album, Music from Big Pink. It has a very kind of Chagall-esque quality to it. And then he did the self-portrait cover as well. In terms of the drawings that you're talking about, in the early 70s, Bob put together, essentially it was the first complete collection of his lyrics. There hadn't been a collection of his lyrics until about 1973. There had been these mimeos that fans had passed back and forth, but the first time his lyrics were ever collected in a single book came out in the early 70s, and it was called Writings and Drawings. And initially, this book was called Words, and we have some of the original kind of mock-ups of the cover of that in the exhibition. And Bob took a very active hand in this. If you get that early edition, I think Knopf published it, and you could still find it relatively cheaply online. Bob included, along with his lyrics, a lot of songs that he had written but had never recorded, things that poems that had never been published, and he put those into this book. And right when it was about to go to press, he said, I want to change it again. And he wanted to include all these drawings that corresponded to songs in the book. So you have a very interesting instance here where you've got this artist kind of responding to his own work in this kind of whimsical way. And so in the first edition of Writings and Drawings, there's 18 of Bob's drawings that relate to songs. But in the archive, there's about 100 drawings. some of which clearly relate to songs, and some of them are just these whimsical kind of freehand drawings. So in the exhibition, we have a handful of those on display as well.
And then they're juxtaposed with a more recent publication called Mondo Scripto from just last year. And it features, again, written manuscripts of some of his most classic songs, at least the examples that are in the exhibit, are, you know, Like a Rolling Stone, Mr. Tambourine Man, All Along the Watchtower, juxtaposed with these drawings that are just so strange. For example, Like a Rolling Stone is paired with his drawing of a portrait of Napoleon. Mr. Tambourine Man shows what looks to be a continental European street scene, and All Along the Watchtower shows two men sitting down for a drink. Maybe they're the Joker and the Thief from that song.
Possible. Or the businessman.
Yeah. Do we understand what that one's all about?
Yeah. I mean, he did about 60 of those drawings, 70 of those drawings. They showed last year at his gallery in London, the Halcyon Gallery, and they were very popular. They sold. And, you know, it's interesting because in some ways he's going back to what he was doing in the early 70s, except the drawings are a lot more sophisticated. And, yes, some of them are like really on the nose in terms of the songs and what he's drawing, and then some of them are just so out there. There's a great one. It's not in the show. I think someone actually purchased this one. It's Song for Woody, which is the first song he ever wrote, and it's a fantastic drawing of Sir Laurence Olivier's Richard III. So if you could decipher that one, then maybe you've cracked the code.
Well, and I think this is, as a curator, this is a big job for you, is trying to understand the motivation of these portraits that are at the center of the exhibit, the face value portraits.
Yeah.
There's some debate over whether these are all real people. Yeah. Are they real names? We don't think some of them are real names. Are they invented portraits or are they real portraits?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I mean, the self-portrait that ended up being the front cover of self-portrait, Bob claims, well, that's not really my self-portrait. It's basically what it is. It's you know, all these different pieces from all these different people that I've kind of put together. And that's what this record, so it's kind of like a self-portrait by unself-portrait in a strange way.
And, collective self-portrait.
Yes, there you go. And, you know, I don't know. Look, Bob named this series Face Value. So clearly he wants people to, I mean, if that's any kind of clue, he wants people to take them for what they are. But of course, what they are is a bit ambiguous because, you know, similar to the Mona Lisa, is she smiling? Is she grimacing? A lot of these portraits, some of them seem to be friendly encounters. Some of them seem to be
pained.
Yeah, pained encounters. You know, what's interesting for me, I guess, as a curator, is not so much figuring out, but just kind of maybe understanding a little bit more about Bob's relationship to, you know, the public, people. How is he seeing people? You know, we're talking about arguably one of the most famous people in the world, been in the spotlight since he was, 19, 20 years old. You know, how he sees other people, how he sees the public. And then with something like Mondo Scripto, those early drawings, how he relates to his own work, which is a, you know, I think is an interesting thing to, you know, as an artist to do. In some ways, those early drawings seem to, the ones we were just talking about, the more whimsical ones, seem to take the edge off some of the songs, which is something that Bob, you know, with an album like Self Portrait, wanted to do. When that record came out, he was, you're talking late 60s, early 70s, he was being considered like Jeremiah the Prophet or something by the counterculture. And that was very troubling to him. And so he made a lot of strange moves to kind of get people off his scent. And so some of these drawings are his own, you know, reveal his own relationship, I guess, to these songs in a lighter, more whimsical way, which I think was, you know, very intentional. Bob takes his work very seriously in terms of, you know, how other people perceive it. That's kind of beyond him. You know.
My guest today is Michael Chaykin, the archivist and curator of the Bob Dylan Archives, the soon-to-be Bob Dylan Center. And Gilcrease Museum is hosting Bob Dylan Face Value and Beyond now through September 15th, which features his visual art as well as a small selection. I say the other half of it sort of gives viewers a sneak preview of what a room in the Bob Dylan Center is likely to look like. And when you first walk in the exhibit, you hear Bob singing, and he's singing Chimes of Freedom, an amazing, amazing song, with a video. Mm-hmm. As well as the original lyrics, which is sort of what you expect to see when you go to a museum devoted to a musical artist.
Yeah.
And is there anything of all the pieces you could have chose, all the different videos and lyric sets that you have, why did you choose this one in particular?
Well, that particular piece in the exhibition is accompanied by a text by Doug Brinkley. Mm-hmm. About Dylan and Tulsa. And, you know, the question that we still get asked is, well, why Tulsa? Why is this here? And so we wanted to have something, as soon as people walked in, it would be a little bit of an orientation of why this makes sense that this is in Tulsa. And so that particular vitrine has a handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence, which the Gilchrist Museum has one of six that exist in the world. It's the copy that Ben Franklin took to the King of Prussia, incredibly. And we have that laid out alongside Chimes of Freedom with this text by Doug Brinkley that it's kind of like, you know, the view from 30,000 feet and how Bob's archive makes sense in the context of what the Gilchrist Museum already collects, a museum that's dedicated to the canon of great American art. And even though I imagine some people will think, oh, that's kind of a pretentious leap, but at the same time, no Declaration of Independence, you know, the thing that essentially kicked off this experiment of democracy, no Chimes of Freedom, you know, 100-some years later, you know. So we just wanted to make a little bit of a connection, I guess, between the kind of things that exist at the Gilchrist Collection or in the Gilchrist Collection and the Bob Dylan archive, and just show that Dylan is a towering American artist and in that tradition of Whitman and these people, and being at the Gilchrist makes a lot of sense.
As you move through the visual art portion, on the far wall of the exhibit, you see two films going in tandem. Mm-hmm. And this is one is a screen test, which was a series of films Andy Warhol made with a variety of people. And he mm-hmm. makes one with Dylan, in which I think the whole purpose was Dylan to be as still as possible.
That's right.
And then, I guess it was almost like a video from World Gone Wrong, yeah. Blood in My Eyes. Yeah. So why these two films?
Yeah. So again, you know, one of the themes of the show is portraiture. And so we have examples of Bob doing his own portrait. We have examples of Bob painting other people's portraits. We wanted to give a couple of examples of other artists capturing Bob in some way. And, you know, Warhol, again, another towering American artist and one of the preeminent portrait painters, especially into the 70s when he almost exclusively became a portrait painter. In the mid-60s, he famously said, I'm not painting anymore. Film is where my head is at. So he would have people come into the factory, which was on, I think, 46th Street in Manhattan in the mid-60s before it moved. And he would have people sit in front of his Bolex camera for 2 or 3 minutes. And anybody. It didn't have to be Bob Dylan. It could be the girlfriend of such and such or, you know. And he essentially said, don't move, sit still, and I'm going to take your portrait. So this, for Warhol, was his idea of what the future of portraiture was going to be like. But, you know, if you look at the Warhol screen test of Bob, you know, for the first 30 seconds or so, you think it's either on pause or you're looking at a photograph.
Yeah, because he's so still.
But then it all just kind of dissembles. And that was Warhol's intention. Eventually, if you're sitting there for 2 or 3 minutes, after a little while, you start becoming very self-conscious and very uncomfortable. And there's something very revealing about that whole process. And I think ultimately that's what Warhol was trying to get at. Okay, just be as still as possible. Yeah, don't even think. But then, you know, your brain is going in overdrive.
And of course, you're in this dark studio and Dylan is still wearing his sunglasses. So there's already a sense of, I've got a barrier already.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're very beautifully framed. You know, they're very simple shots, but they do reveal something of people's characters. And, you know, Bob, at a certain point, starts becoming very uncomfortable with the whole thing. The story kind of continues after that, because after Bob did his screen test, he took a Warhol painting. He famously said, okay, well, what do I get now? I just gave you this. And Warhol and his assistant, Gerard Malanga, were just kind of stunned. And Bob said, I'll take that. And it was one of the Silver Elvis paintings, which Dylan ended up trading to his manager at the time, Albert Grossman, for a couch. rock and roll. I mean, what that painting would be worth today is the other portrait is a lot later, and it's by the musician Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, who shot some, I think, just really beautiful, simple footage of Bob in the early 90s on the streets of London, interacting with people, juggling, doing all these tricks. And it ultimately became the music video for a song on World Gone Wrong called Blood in My Eyes. But we're showing them, as perhaps Warhol would typically, side by side. And there was a kind of a magic there that we didn't really anticipate, because the Warhol film is on the left and Blood in My Eyes is on the right. And occasionally the two Bobs look at one another.
Well, I thought it was interesting because one is so static and the other is so kinetic.
That's right.
Too.
That's right.
The last part of the exhibit features some of the things you would expect to see at a museum that honors a notable personage, and that is sort of the memorabilia, the Smithsonian sort of look, the leather jacket, and there's pictures from the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. That was the famous appearance where Bob electrified and horrified the folk music audience, and of course the leather jacket he wore there. But I found was also interesting, I guess at that same time when he puts together the electric band, there's another appearance, I believe it's in the UK, where he's wearing this tweed suit, and it's a film, I guess. Is it a D.A. Pennybaker film?
So D.A. Pennybaker shot that. He shot Bob twice in the 60s, once in 1965, which became the film Don't Look Back. And then he shot Bob again full year later in 1966 when Bob toured Europe. So when Bob toured Europe in 66, he had already, the Newport Festival was in July of 65, so he had gone electric. But UK audiences weren't prepared for what they were about to see. I mean, news and, just didn't travel, especially like pop music. I mean, probably most of the people who showed up to those London gigs just assumed that he was still playing an acoustic guitar. And that was the first half of the set. And then there was an intermission, and then he would come out with a full rock band, which essentially was the band. Robbie Robertson was playing with them. And so that piece that you're talking about in the exhibition is, this past year, we just restored in high definition all of Pennybaker's 1966 footage, which had never been done before. A fraction of it was transferred digitally back in the 90s, early 2000s for a Scorsese documentary called No Direction Home. He uses pieces of it, but there was so much more. And it was a bit of a tangle. It was like in the archive, but it wasn't cataloged properly, and we needed to like clean the footage. So over the past year, we've done that. And so we've digitized the HD, something like 30 hours of footage. And so the piece in the exhibition kind of shows some of the before and after. This is, this was the original footage. This is now the HD footage. And you can see how much more detail there is. But yeah, all that material is from 1966.
But I was really struck by what it's actually depicting, which is him on stage getting booed, the boos continuing as he's leaving the theater in a car. And I just thought, man, that must have been an incredible, stressful time. It's like, here he thinks, okay, this is my direction, and yet people are
not getting it.
Not only not getting it, but
angry
and antagonistic to it. And there's this scene where he just says, please, just stop booing. Stop booing.
Yeah.
Whatever, quit. and the concert is over and he's leaving,
And they're still booing him as he's getting into the car.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I can only imagine like the people who deeply love those early records and saw Bob in a certain light, they just felt a deep sense of betrayal and that Bob had gone pop, rock for serious folkies was like the devil's music in a way. And like, how could Dylan embrace this, But if you had listened to the records, he'd already gone electric, a year before. But just audiences really weren't prepared. I mean, there certainly wasn't any footage there was no footage of really the Newport Folk Festival. So people heard, Dylan did this thing in Newport. He played with the band, but nobody had really seen it. Nobody heard it. We have the footage now. But at the time, it was still so new, and Dylan was this fast-moving phenomena. You just couldn't really keep up. And so probably most of the people who were at that concert just assumed that he was going to do, the songs that he did on Free Will and Bob Dylan or another side of Bob Dylan. And he did. We just did them in a radically different way. And but again, the set was broken up into two halves. He came out solo, and then there was an intermission, and then he came out with a full electric band. And they were loud. They were really, really loud. Playing through big amps and Fender guitars, but that's where Dylan's head was at.
What Bob Dylan did throughout his career. He always changing it up.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it was always, the thing about Bob that I've come to appreciate more as I've gotten deeper into the archive and working with the collection is how all that stuff was really there from the beginning. It was really just a matter of all this stuff coming to the forefront. Like Bob, when he was a kid in Hibbing, and we've got recordings in the archive from 1956, from 1958, he's doing Little Richard and Buddy Holly. He wants to be a rock and roll guy, So that was always there. Guthrie, a little bit later, became the character that galvanized him, and he worked his way through that. But Bob was interested in art. He's interested in culture. He's interested in popular culture. And even though he probably couldn't write songs like I Want to Hold Your Hand or She Loves You, I think he was really engrossed, as a lot of people were, by just the phenomena and what they were doing and the Beatles and the harmonies of the Beatles. Like he heard the Everly Brothers. He heard, because he's from that. He's cut from that same cloth. And so for him to go electric and to play rock music felt like a betrayal. But I mean, he was creating new forms on the fly, and the audiences at that time. I mean, now we listen to those things and we say, "Oh, what a genius!" But at the time, it was. I think that's good art. You know, it's almost indecipherable at the beginning, and it takes some time for it to settle in.
Gilcrease Museum is hosting Bob Dylan, Face Value and Beyond, now through September 15th. My guest today, Michael Chaykin, the archivist and curator of the Bob Dylan Archives. You've talked about some of the projects, like getting D.A. Pennybaker's footage digitized and put into HD. How much is there still to do on the archives? I would imagine there's still a lot to do.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, we have a full-time collections manager now, which has been a huge step forward for us, someone who could actually be there day in and day out working with the collection. His name's Mark Davidson, and he's been there for a little over a year now. So most of my attention, or more of my attention, has gone towards the Bob Dylan Center. And so doing things like, I mean, one, we needed to preserve the Pennybaker footage, because that was in kind of a state where if we didn't get to this now, it could really deteriorate and the color could be lost. But we want to take that HD footage and we want to use it in the context of the Dylan Center. So it also becomes grist for us in terms of what we're trying to create, the environment that we want to create in that space. You know, most of the sessions, the recording sessions, are finished. We're looking. There's some from the 80s, early 90s that still need to be done. We just did all the Street Legal sessions, which is a record Bob made in the late 70s. We just did all the Infidels sessions, which is a record that Bob made in the early 80s. And a lot of these are on obsolete formats, especially the Infidels. It was recorded. It's like an early version of digital recording, and there's no players to play back these tapes.
Is this like digital audio tape?
Yeah. Well, it's even earlier than that.
Oh, wow.
It's like this digital format that is way obsolete. And there was one laboratory, sound lab, that was able to do it for us. So we just got all the Infidel sessions. But, you know, we were lucky in the sense that by the time this archive came to us, something like 70% of it was already digitized in some way, shape, or form. We're kind of cleaning stuff up. We're doing some stuff again. And we're doing some things for the first time. So, you know, the archive started arriving in Tulsa in March of 2016. And I would say there's probably like 10% left that we need to do, which is pretty incredible considering how big this archive is.
So it sounds at this point it's about getting to the breaking ground of the center.
Yeah. So the Bob Dylan Center is opening in the Tulsa Arts District, close to the Guthrie Center in 2021. Again, that's where a lot of my attention has turned. And that's why a lot of the events and the programs and bringing artists in, and, you know, it's all being done now under the aegis of the Bob Dylan Center. We even have a logo or a font because we want to, you know, we want to reinforce it, that this is kind of the mothership and this is the public face of what we're doing. So when the Bob Dylan Center actually opens up, it just feels like a natural consequence of this long run-up.
Well, we'll look forward to that long run-up and the opening when it happens. And in the meantime, you can go to Gilcrease Museum and get a sneak peek.
Absolutely.
Michael Chaykin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Chaykin is the archivist and curator of the Bob Dylan Archives. The Archives is presenting a show at Gilcrease Museum titled Bob Dylan, Face Value and Beyond. It's now on display at Gilcrease Museum through September 15th. For information, visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. We're going to leave you with a little music by Bob Dylan. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory, and the views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Keep a clean nose, wash the plain clothes. You don't need a weatherman.